So this is the study for March 17th, 2023. Little children, the time is 19:21 hours, daylight savings time, here in the North American Eastern time zone, which is common to the city of Toronto, for example, among others. The time, as I said, 1921 hours, right? So today's study, first of all, in the Wild Road article, is chapter 4, paragraph 2, Manfred Bitak. It says, in his excavations of the ancient city of Avaris at the site of the modern-day Tal el-Daba, uncovered evidence that Semites, that is, descendants of Shem, inhabited that city, that's Tal el-Daba, at the time that it was the Hyksos Egyptian capital city. Right. Another city, Pithom. Let me adjust this, first of all, before we get too far here. Another city, Pithom, has been identified as a site of modern Tel el-Maskuta in the eastern end of the Wadi Tumilat, 16 kilometers west of Ismailia. And the Pithom identification is from Exodus chapter 1, verse 11. Footnote. In the translation of Brenton, it's called Pytho, but it certainly is a city mentioned in the Bible. Excavations at Tel el-Maskuta from 1978 to 19—let's get this where we can read it, where you can read it. Excavations at Tel el-Maskuta from 1978 to 1985 were conducted under direction of John S. Holliday, Jr. of the University of Toronto, and have established the occupational history of the site, says Bryant G. Wood. Prior to about 610 BC, quoting Mr. Wood, or the Saite period, the only occupation was during the Hyksos period. That is, prior to 610 BC, that was the only occupation, Wood states. This can simply be interpreted by the layperson as an assertion that the Israelites were working on building the city of Pithom, Exodus 101, under the Hyksos. So perhaps we should look at Exodus 101. See what we have here. Here it is. They went building cities, namely Pithom and Ramses. Exodus 1:1. Okay. So this is very strong evidence that the Israelites were working when they were subject to the slave labor of the Egyptians. They were working as slaves to the Hyksos, based on that, because the city of Pithom is mentioned and it's been identified. And we believe, therefore, that since there was no other occupation of that city before 610 of the common of before the common era of the BCE time period, before 610 there was no other occupation of that city except by the Hyksos. Therefore, if it's true that the Israelites long before BCE 610, long before that time, 610 BCE, were working there, then they must have been working under the Hyksos, because that was the only occupation of the city. So that proves that we know, all of a sudden, we know a whole lot more about what happened. Both the discoveries of Tel el-Daba, ancient Avaris, and of Tel el-Maskuta, ancient Pithom, are important to our quest for history in Israel's Egyptian sojourn. But the Python discovery is particularly so because of its chronological context, which anchors the BG, or Blessed Genealogy, for it was not long after the Hyksos left Egypt in our Blessed Genealogy that Israel departed also. Okay, how do we know that? Well, we know this only by events as dated in our BG. There's no other way that we find this out. The Hyksos departed in 1533 or 1532 BCE, with almost the first year one, he's the first king called Amos in Egypt, his year one in late 1552 BCE, and Israel, after the Hyksos departed in 1533 or 1532, Israel stayed until 1493. Now, how do we know that? Well, partly because we know what the Exodus date was, it was 1493, and partly because we know when the Hyksos left, because we know it was somewhere around 19 years after Amos the First took the throne. Very close to 1533, therefore. We know it was somewhere in that area. And that's also a 40-year difference. 40 years different from 1493. So, it's not inconceivable, because the Hyksos were conquered by Amos the First. And it's not inconceivable that when the Hyksos departed, Israel was kept as a slave labor force working for Amos the First. Seems very reasonable. But also, it's not reasonable from the standpoint of slavery. Of course, it's just reasonable from the standpoint of that this is the practical thing that the Egyptians, if they were being practically minded, if they wanted to keep the Israelites as workers, then they would benefit from the labor that the Israelites could give them. So they wouldn't have left the Israelites, they wouldn't have let the Israelites depart, I should say. They wouldn't have left them to their own devices, or they wouldn't have let them stay with the Hyksos when they were driving out the Hyksos. They defeated the Hyksos, first of all, and then they allowed the Hyksos to leave. It wasn't as though the Hyksos ran away. They lost the battle, first of all. But anyway, this is what... But the dating is, with regard to the dates, Israel being separated from the Hyksos by 40 years in their departure, this is merely the way it looks to us. But we are very much interested in finding what the evidence tells us. The occupation of Python, coinciding with the Hyksos, is a very important clue that Israel worked under Hyksos, and that the Hyksos were the ones not knowing Joseph. Because there was this Bible verse that says, in Exodus 1, verse 8, it says, in time there arose over Egypt a new king who did not know Joseph. A new king who did not know Joseph. So that new king could well have been the Hyksos king. And that fits perfectly with this current knowledge that we have about the Hyksos being the ones under whom Israel was subjected, or were subjected to slave labor, because the Hyksos rose at a certain period of time in Egypt's history. They weren't there the whole time. They came into Egypt at a certain point, so that's consistent with, and it was around 1640 BCE when they came in to become rulers in the Delta, area of Egypt, and that is another whole topic that we have discussed in other parts of our articles. But Moses, it implies that Moses was raised by Hyksos royalty, because the book of Exodus makes it plain that it was under the same kind of tyranny under which Israel was oppressed and made to build Python that Moses came to be born, his life put at risk under Pharaoh's orders. If you recall the Bible account, which tells us that Moses was supposed to have been put to death, but because all the firstborn sons were supposed to have been put to death, but that didn't happen. In the case of Moses, he was put into an ark and placed among the reeds of the Nile River. That's the story that we know from the Bible. Now, it turns out, as we read in Exodus chapter 1, just to confirm this, if it is a son that is born in verse 16, when the Hebrew women gave birth, if it is a son, you must also put it to death. That was the Pharaoh's orders. That was the king of Egypt's orders. Interestingly, he is not even called Pharaoh there. He's called a king. That's interesting. But we know that there's more to this idea of the 40-year difference between the time that the Hyksos were driven out and the time when Israel left, there being about 40 years between them, because Moses departed Egypt for 40 years and came back to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. That was a 40-year period. So perhaps Moses was indeed part of the Hyksos to some extent, or not really, because we know he killed a man who was, according to what we've just been discussing, it sounds like he killed a Hyksos, one of the Hyksos forces. And then Moses had to flee Egypt because he killed a man. But we don't really know who he killed. Perhaps what happened also could have been that Moses killed one of the new slave masters who came in under Amos the First, and because of that, because of his killing one of the new slave masters, he fled Egypt to save his own life, and he had to wait for 40 years, whereas to come before he could come back and be unrecognized unwanted, so that he wouldn't be pursued. He wouldn't perhaps be subject to the death penalty after 40 years if he was returning, is the idea there. But the point is, he went away for 40 years, he came back, and why did he have to go away for 40 years before he came back? If he just killed one of the Hyksos and they then left Egypt, that doesn't seem to explain it quite as well as if he'd killed one of the new slave masters who were then ruling from then on. But the point is, there was an important connection here. The 40 years here, We already dated the Exodus as 1493. That date's been established by independent means, by our own efforts. But then in 1533, we have another date established from the Egyptian chronology, which is when the Hyksos were driven out, and it's independent of 1493. Independently established, but 40 years different, which is remarkable because we know that Moses left Egypt 40 years before the Exodus. So that's according to the Bible. We know that. He came back when he was 80 years old. He was 40 years old when he left, or in his 40th year, and then he came back when he was in his 80th year. So those things are directly from the Bible. We're not going to look up those scriptures right now because we've got enough to study here already. But, I mean, we will eventually see these scriptures, I'm sure, because they're mentioned in other articles. So, and they're in the Bible. As we read through, we're going to see it. That Moses was at the Exodus, 80 years old, or in his 80th year. That's just what happened. So that was the timing. But he was in his 40th year when he ran away. And evidently he ran away during this time, the same time when it's very interesting alignment here, where the Hyksos left at the same time approximately as Moses did, but for very different reasons. Perhaps it was a time of turmoil if the Hyksos left and then Moses left shortly after that, or it's hard to say, it's hard to believe that it was the other way around, that Moses left first, or even at the same time as the Hyksos, unless of course, well, it's hard to say. It's hard to say without knowing more. So we don't know a lot about this, but we do know there's an interesting 40-year correspondence there between the time the Hyksos were driven out and the Exodus. And that coincides with the 40 years that Moses spent in Midian. So that's the most significant, interesting thing. I think that was discussed in quite a bit of detail when I first discovered that coincidence, which was in the or synchronization, I should say, which was I think written about in the Crucible article. First of all, it was such a major discovery at the time I first wrote about it, though, because we had no other evidence ever from history that would ever have given any confirmation to the idea that Moses left Egypt 40 years before the Exodus. And here we had, and do have, this other piece of information that's 40 years earlier than the Exodus, which aligns with that information that we have about Moses in the Bible. So it's really significant. And if we had maybe even one more little piece of information, it could just, you know, just launch that whole story into mainstream history. It's close already because of this this work, that this interesting and powerful information from this chapter 2 here, I mean paragraph 2 of chapter 4 here, of the wild road ahead to history. It's a wild road ahead in some ways, because it's uncharted territory, and there are similarities with Moses having to leave Egypt. He must have had a rather difficult road as well for his own path at the time that he left Egypt. So let's go to Genesis chapter 1. We're going to Genesis 17. When Abram got to be 99 years old, then Jehovah appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and prove yourself faultless, and I will give my covenant between me and you, that I may multiply you very, very much." At this, Abram fell upon his face, and God continued to speak with him, saying, "As for me, look, my covenant is with you, and you will certainly become a father of a crowd of nations, and your name will not be called Abram anymore, and your name must become Abraham." Abram meant father is exalted, and Abraham means father of a multitude. "Because a father of a crowd of nations I will make you, And I will make you very, very fruitful and will make you become nations, and kings will come out of you. And I will carry out my covenant between me and you and your seed after you, according to their generations, for a covenant to time indefinite, to prove myself God to you and to your seed after you. And I will give to you and to your seed after you the land of your alien residences, even the entire land of Canaan, for a possession to time indefinite. And I will prove myself God to them. And God said further to Abraham, as for you, you are to keep my covenant, you and your seed after you, according to their generations. This is my covenant that you men will keep between me and you men, even your seed after you. Every male of yours must get circumcised, and you must get circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it must serve as a sign of the covenant between me and you. And every male of yours, 8 days old, must be circumcised according to your generations. Anyone born in the house, and anyone purchased with money from any foreigner who is not from your seed. Every man born in your house, and every man purchased with money of yours, must without fail get circumcised. And my covenant in the flesh of you men must serve as a covenant to time indefinite. And an uncircumcised male who will not get the flesh of his foreskin circumcised, even that soul must be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. And God went on to say to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you must not call her name Sarai, because Sarah is her name. Sarai means contentiousness, and Sarah means princess. And I will bless her, and also give you a son from her. And I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. At this, Abraham fell upon his face and began to laugh, and to say in his heart, will a man 100 years old have a child born? And will Sarah, yes, will a woman 90 years old give birth? After that, Abraham said to the true God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you, or Ishmael. To this God said, Sarah, your wife, is indeed bearing you a son, and you must call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for a covenant to time indefinite to his seed after him. But as regards Ishmael, I have heard you. Look, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him very, very much. He will certainly produce 12 chieftains, and I will make him become a great nation. However, my covenant I shall establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this appointed time next year. With that, God finished speaking with him and went up from Abraham. Abraham then proceeded to take Ishmael his son, and all the men born in his house, and everyone purchased with money of his, every male among the men of the household of Abraham, and he went to circumcising the flesh of their foreskins in this very day, just as God had spoken with him. And Abraham was 99 years old when he had the flesh of his foreskin circumcised, and Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he had the flesh of his foreskin circumcised. In this very day, Abraham got circumcised, and also Ishmael, his son. And all the men of this household, or his household, all the men of his household, anyone born in the house, and anyone purchased with money from a foreigner, got circumcised with him. So the covenant of circumcision was given there. The covenant was mentioned in verse 10. This is my covenant that you men will keep between me and you men, even your seed after you. Every male of yours must get circumcised. Well, we know that covenant lasted up until the time of the impalement, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, at which time the law was abolished, and so the law of circumcision was done away with also, as the Christian elders determined shortly after that time of Jesus' crucifixion. So, which that the crucifixion being in 30 CE, or the year 30 of the Common Era, so up until that time, circumcision was the part of the law. It wasn't the Mosaic law. It was a covenant given to Abraham, as we see here. It wasn't from Moses. It was before that, before Moses came on the scene, quite a long time before that, even hundreds of years prior. So, but that's one of the things that's talked about. The more interesting thing here, perhaps, is the fact that Abram was 99 years old before he even had a promise of a son, and he was 100 years old before he had a son of his own. And Sarah became known as Sarah, and she was beforehand known as Sarai, and Abraham was known as Abram before. Their names were changed to Abraham and Sarah, respectively, but also Sarah was 90 years old at the birth of her what did Abram say here? Yeah, he said, will a man 100 years old? In verse 17, will a man 100 years old have a child born? And will Sarah, a woman 90 years old, give birth? So he was quite incredulous. Abraham didn't really have complete confidence that this was going to happen. But because he was 100 years old, when he had his son, his first son, that means that this 100 years became the period of time that symbolized the time of one generation, so that when Jehovah gave the prophecy about the fourth generation, it automatically referred to 400 years as well, because 100 years for Abraham was a generation. So that's the most significant point that I notice here in this chapter 17 of Genesis. Although the covenant of circumcision is very important, we know that was followed by very many people. And I guess we know if we have a Jewish ancestry, if we did have, or perhaps not, because it came to be a very common practice in the hospitals of the modern day, of course, to circumcise children. So it didn't have to do with whether you had Jewish ancestry, but yeah, that's true. I don't think it indicates anything about ancestry, but it certainly gives one pause, because many of us probably do have Jewish ancestry in some way or other, if we go back far enough, and you know, just far enough, and not, you know, I mean, if we didn't have Jewish ancestry, at the time when the Jews, by the time we went back to the beginning, the very inception of the Jewish nation, if we had no Jewish ancestry back that far, then we couldn't have had any, even if we went back further in our ancestry, because it's only when the Jews, of course, became a nation that, well, actually it was when Abraham became the the holder of this covenant, and the that's right that this began. So yeah, right. And Ishmael had it as well. It wasn't just the Jews. It was, that's right. So it was to all of Abraham's sons, not just the Jews. So a great many of the other sons of Abraham also followed the covenant of circumcision, according to this very chapter, which is not always something that we think very much about if we're not in the in the lineage of Ishmael, that we wouldn't. I think we're perhaps not even in the lineage of Isaac either. If we're not Jewish, we're not necessarily in his lineage, although we could be somewhere along the way. It's hard to say, really, with 100% confidence about that, perhaps. But it would, you know, it would be a whole complete significant, a completely enormous research project to try and ascertain where, you know, where the Jewish ancestry, where it is, you know, where it's found today, as far as what lineages contain Jewish ancestry and so on. But also, it's not just the Jewish ancestry, there's other sons as well. Well, Isaac had a son, Jacob, but Jacob had, okay, but he also had a son called Esau, so that there are also the sons of Esau, not just the sons of Jacob from Isaac. So, and they were all following the covenant of circumcision too. So if we're going to talk about the covenant of circumcision, it's a much more nebulous, perhaps, thing to follow, or it's much more unclear how we could trace all of the descendants who were under the covenant of. I'm getting too warm. Wait a minute. Under that covenant, it would be a little bit more difficult than some other things, and a lot more difficult than. And still other things. So, but yeah, we don't have to be burdened down by it. It's an opportunity, perhaps, for consideration. But there it is. You notice in verse 1 that Jehovah said to Abraham, or Abram as he was then called, he said, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and prove yourself faultless." And the covenant, one of the covenants, it wasn't the covenant of circumcision. It was another covenant. It was the covenant. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. No, I guess it looks like in verse 10, this is the condition. He must circumcise everyone in his household and everyone purchased with money from any foreigner who's not from his seed. And if he didn't do that, then he wouldn't be under the covenant. But the covenant gave him a promise that he would become a father of a crowd of nations, and he would inherit the land of Canaan in verse 8, the father of a crowd of nations in verse 5, and he would inherit the land of Canaan in verse 8. And also, his seed would also inherit the land. His descendants, in other words, would also inherit the land of Canaan, the promised land. So this is the idea of the promised land, too. It's initially presented. But we notice, though, we've already heard the promise. It was in Genesis chapter 12. We saw it in Genesis chapter 15, the covenant to give Abraham the land, or Abram the land at that time. He was still called Abram up until he was 99 years old. So this is definitely after he had permanently moved into Canaan at the age of 75. That much we can say with confidence. There's so much to say, you know, about I don't want to get started on the book of Jasher again, but there's so much to say about that with regard to learning more about the life of Abraham. But as I was saying, we determined the chronology already in terms of when Abram was born. We determined that from the date of the Exodus. It wasn't dependent on the book of Jasher. So fascinating, but it did coincide with the information in the book of Jasher quite remarkably well, or so it certainly appears to be, you know, to be absolutely although it's not, we know the book of Jasher is not 100% reliable at all, but it certainly appears to be a very very useful confirmation of the chronology, with Abram born in 2206 BCE. So when he was 99 or 100, it must have been in about the year 2107. Or perhaps 2106 or something like that. But, you know, perhaps that time. Well, we know that Isaac, we don't know it, but we've established in the chronology, we've given him a birth date of 2105, Isaac, so it's about 2106, actually, this time. There could be differences in the months of what month, you know, I mean, a difference of from the beginning or end of a year being so many years and so many months and so on. But we've given a time period of, it could be, if Abraham was 100 years old at the birth of his son, he could have been 100 years old plus some months. So, you know, it could be 100 years old in 10 months. We don't know. So from 2206 to 2105 is perfectly acceptable as a difference between the birth dates of the father and son. It's not unacceptable, anyway. And that's the dates that we have up till now. We're allowing for the fact that there are periods of some months, you know, that are very often added on to the end of the age of a person. If they're given a certain age, then there are that many years plus some months, very typically. So that's all for today's study, I believe. I'm still struggling with my understanding of what's wrong with my health. Today I've stopped eating the iodine, so, because I really thought that the iodine was probably what was causing my problems. But I still might have another problem with the calcium and the vitamin D, too. So, the vitamin D, I mean, not D2, I mean vitamin D as well. vitamin D and the calcium might have been another problem, I don't know. But when I eat food, I'm trying to ascertain what food makes me feel good and what food doesn't make me feel good. And I'm having some difficulty finding food that makes me feel good, that actually is, you know, substantial food. Because if I just eat fruit, I don't think I'll survive forever. You know, I can't just eat that, so I have to eat other things and try and find food that makes me feel good. And hopefully get better and recover. It's kind of like, you know, I have some symptoms that are, but I only have the symptoms when I eat. That's the thing. After I've eaten a meal, then I feel, you know, but I'm going to get weak if I don't eat too. I'm getting weak because I'm not eating. But then when I eat, I get some slight nausea again. But not everything I eat, though. Not everything's the same. And I'm trying to ascertain what's different. Like, is the dairy what's causing my issue? And I have to be careful about my well water. Maybe my well water's causing an issue. I don't know. But, I mean, I have to try all the different processes of elimination. I have to eliminate all the different variables and find out what could be, you know, at the root of my problem. If it's just a nutritional issue, you know, but I don't know yet. I do have a lot of good food, so I don't know. I mean, I believe I have a lot of good, I mean, a lot of perfectly fine, great food, you know, great, healthy food. You know, unless, you know, you can start to, you know, you can go to extremes and start to assume that, you know, somebody's putting poison in your food, but that would be pretty difficult to stop if somebody really wanted to do that. That would be rather it would be quite an extreme measure to try to prevent that. But I mean, if somebody really wanted to, but I mean, somebody could, for example, put something in some part of what you're consuming. So we might be able to eliminate some of the sources of our issues. But I really don't think that we should believe that. You know, I don't think that's the only possibility at all. There's many possible things that could be wrong with causing my health problems. I mean, there are many things. I don't think that it's sabotage as the main theory at all. So I'm not really too concerned about pursuing that one, but I mean, I'm not really involved in that one right now, pursuing that. But I do want to consider everything. I do want to try to eliminate all the possible sources of the problem, and then see, you know, right now I feel actually pretty good, but why is it I don't feel good when I eat? That's the question. If I have very high level of calcium in my blood, though, that might explain it, I guess. But I definitely need to take vitamin K2 still, right? But, I mean, it's a vitamin that's needed in order for the proper usage of calcium. So if I do have high calcium, and if I do have a lot of vitamin D still in my system, I do need to take vitamin K2. And I never get a bad reaction when I eat the K2. But then again, I generally eat the K2 and then I eat some food with it. So I might need to try and isolate whether eating the K2 by itself causes me any issue. And I don't believe it does. There are times when I eat the K2 without other eating anything else, I believe. So I think I would. But I'll have to try that and make sure that K2 itself doesn't cause a bad reaction. So everything has to be isolated. You have to try eating just one thing and nothing else and see what that causes. And then try eating one thing, a different thing, after a while, that is. After, you know, let's say another maybe 24 hours later or more, you try eating one other thing and only that other thing and see what happens. You need to isolate what's causing the issue. And the problem with the iodine, I need to explain. Iodine is in the salt. And I've been putting extra salt in my everything. You know, I've been putting salt, and it's got iodine in it. And all, I learned that dairy products have iodine, and I've been taking a lot of dairy. And I've been adding iodine as a supplement to my matcha tea lattes. The addition of iodine to all these different things, and there's iodine in my water. I put salt in my water. And I'm supposed to be drinking salt water, saline, as a way to flush out vitamin D from my system. I'm supposed to be drinking salt water. To get rid of calcium, you're supposed to eat protein too. I'm not eating much protein. I should eat some more protein. Got some bacon I need to fry up too. Maybe I can eat that. Maybe that'll be good. I need to try something different. But, you know, right now I feel really good. Yeah, I mean, right now I feel great. I don't know. So it's hard to isolate. Also, you know, you might say, well, there's some psychological factors to do with health that are not physical health. But, like, if I'm under more pressures or stress, that's possible. Then I might not be able to assess what my health is really like. But I don't believe there isn't any objective measure of health. I really don't. So there's no way to measure it. So you can't go to a physician and say, measure my health and tell me if I'm healthy. Although, I mean, they can measure vital signs, you know, they can measure all that, but that can be determined for oneself. Whether if you don't have shortness of breath, you don't have, you know, or if you do have certain things like weakness in your legs, you're not, you know, There are many possible things that can cause each different symptom that you might have too. But you might not have shortness of breath. You might not have a weak heart rate or tachycardia, which is a heart rate above 100 beats per minute. If you don't have that, you may not have that. You know, that's another sign of some problems. But I don't have that. But I mean, I could, right? I mean, so I have to monitor my heart rate and make sure my heart rate's not, you know, elevated above. Yeah, my heart rate's about, you know, 1 per second or so, you know, 60 or 80 per minute or something right now, I think. Maybe it's a little more than 60 per minute, but it's not very fast. 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, pretty much a very reasonable resting heart rate. But, I mean, I'm wondering if publishing a video every day is having any effect on my health, but I don't think that would cause me to react differently to my food. I mean, that's the thing. I just think there's something going on, and I have to stop basically most of my supplements. If you know, I have to stop most of my supplements and be very, very wary of taking my supplements I have to pray that Jehovah will show me, right, what to do, and I'll find the answer to my issue. The thing is, Jehovah can find anything. He can show us anything. He can teach us anything. I don't have upset stomach either. You know, when I say nausea, like right now I don't have upset stomach. It's more my body reacting. Yeah, it's hard to describe. I don't get an upset stomach. I just get this, like instead of feeling, I don't feel satisfied when I eat. I don't like feel, wow, when I eat something, I don't feel that's really good. It doesn't satisfy me when I eat. It gives me more of a feeling of, you know, I don't know what you call it, delirium maybe or something, or you know, whatever it is. It's a slight bit of anxiety or something when I eat, or it's not anxiety either. It's discomfort is the word, a slight bit of discomfort. You know, a little bit of a reaction, I guess like an allergic reaction, sort of. So, it's kind of like that. But, you know, it gives me a little bit more. So it's like, yeah, it could be a hyperactive thyroid. Could be a hyperactive thyroid, right? Because caused by the iodine that I was taking. Could be that. That might take a while to calm down. It could be that. So when I'm not eating now, I just feel fine. But I have to eat, right? And every time I eat, I don't feel so great. So that's the problem. I mean, I need to know. So I'm trying to eat smaller meals, if that will help, or try different food and so on. I don't think I should eat a lot of food, but then if I don't eat, I'm going to lose weight. You know, I'm not going to be strong enough to do anything if I don't eat. So, yeah, there's just something wrong with my system right now. Definitely wrong with my system. But tomorrow, I might not, you know, I might be all better again. And I might be worse, you know, but I'm not knowing right now. But I was really bad. Yeah, I'm getting good sleep right now. Yeah, I'm getting much better sleep. Yeah, so I'm having a much better time. Yeah, a lot of things are improved. So I think if it was a vitamin D overdose, then it's probably on course to getting better. Because my sleep and my problem with frequent urination, those are gone. I'm having a much more normal night and day. Everything's more normal. So I am improving. Yeah. But I don't know how long it will take to be completely recovered. My libido is good, too. I mean, it's better than... I mean, it's really good. It's powerful and it's strong. So I know there's some good things happening, but yeah. It's very, very precarious. I guess every day is really precarious when you think about it. Every day we could eat the wrong food that could later on develop into a habit that eventually leads to our death. So every day is precarious in that sense. So Abram had his first son at the age of 100 years old. And that's why the generation was said to be 100 years. That's today's study, little children. It's March 17th, 2023. The time is 2013 hours. I love you. My name is Ward Green. This is a great opportunity for us to come together and study God's Word and the articles also with regard to the Blessed Genealogy. And I hope you've enjoyed it today, little children. I will be hopefully back with you again tomorrow. And have a wonderful day, and remember to love one another and always seek first the kingdom in Jesus' name, so that all the other good things can be added to you. And of course, Jehovah is the creator of all things. That's something. He's our creator. So I had a thought about this the other day. You know, when we die, right, our spirit returns to the true God who gave it. That's what happens when we die. Our spirit returns to Jehovah. So we shouldn't fear death. You know, I mean, our spirit will return to Jehovah. Now, that doesn't mean that we will be a spirit creature necessarily, but our spirit will be available for use. The spirit force that is in us now returns to Jehovah, and he can, of course, resurrect us as a spirit creature, or he can resurrect us as a human as well in the paradise earth. He's got the power to do both those things. So, bye for now. I love you again, sweetie. Love to everyone.